Are you a workaholic? A lot of us who put in long hours and diligent effort into our jobs might use the term casually, but workaholism is a real problem for many people, and it's not the same thing as working hard. Joining us to make the difference clear is Melissa Clark, author of the new book, Never Not Working: Why the Always-On Culture is Bad for Business and How to Fix It. Melissa is an associate professor of industrial and organizational psychology at the University of Georgia, where she leads the Healthy Work Lab. Here she is with five of her big ideas.
Hello, I'm Melissa Clark, associate professor of industrial organizational psychology and author of Never Not Working: Why the Always-On Culture is Bad for Business and How to Fix It. In the book, I dive into the science behind workaholism, supplemented with personal stories of individuals impacted by workaholism and overwork culture, as well as changemakers in the industry. Here are five key insights from my book. Insight number one, workaholism is more than just long work hours. It would be incorrect to assume that every employee working long hours is a workaholic. There are a variety of reasons someone might work long hours, including financial demands, a busy season that makes long hours unavoidable, or a demanding boss who requires extra hours. Workaholism is less about these external factors and more about internal motivators. So what is workaholism then? Scholars have identified four key components. The first is the most obvious: long work hours. Workaholics tend to work well beyond what is required and expected. They take work with them on vacations, refuse to take sick days, and bring work into virtually every aspect of their life. But workaholism is much more than just long hours spent working. Workaholism also involves that feeling in the pit of your stomach that you can't rest, that you ought to be working all the time. The technical term scholars use to describe this motivation is introjected motivation. Along with this internal pressure comes feeling negative emotions when you're not working. This can include feeling guilty and anxious when taking time off work, or feeling frustrated or irritated when something prevents you from working. For many workaholics, there's no legitimate excuse for not working, so any activity that detracts from working is likely to make the workaholic feel guilty. The final aspect of workaholism is cognitive. It's the fact that even if you are not physically doing work, you are thinking about that email you should send, mulling over that upcoming work project, or ruminating about something that happened at work that day. Workaholism, just like any aspect of our personality or work style, exists on a continuum. It's not as cut and dried as you either are or aren't a workaholic. You might relate to some of these aspects of workaholism, but not all of them. Regardless, just because you may not relate to being a full-blown workaholic, it doesn't mean you aren't at an increased risk of negative outcomes of overwork. Insight number two, workaholism is different than work engagement, and here's why it matters. On the surface, workaholism and work engagement can look very similar, since both involve investing a great deal of time and energy into your work. But there are some important differences. Here are two key questions to consider. One, where is the energy being spent? And two, what is the motivation to work? First, let's look at where the energy is being spent. Engagement is thought of as what's achieved while working, a state of being excited and vigorously absorbed in one's work. On the other hand, much of what defines workaholism occurs outside of those work boundaries. Tinkering with your work project instead of going to the beach, constantly taking work calls when you're with your family, or having obsessive thoughts about work. When the energy of work consistently permeates every aspect of your life and you are unable to keep that in check, that suggests workaholism. Engaged workers have a much easier time turning off work, mentally and physically, at the appropriate time, whereas workaholics cannot. Second, an even more critical differentiator between engagement and workaholism is the motivation behind work. Psychologists have discovered that a key driver of employee engagement is intrinsic motivation, which is when someone does something because they love it and they genuinely find the work interesting. Given this, it probably isn't surprising that organizational scholars have found employees that are engaged are happier, healthier, and more productive. But there is another type of motivation that drives people to put work at the center of their lives: introjected motivation. Internal feelings that we ought to always be working, striving to prove our worth, are the essence of introjected motivation. In contrast to intrinsic motivation, organizational scholars have linked introjected motivation along with workaholism to a variety of negative outcomes. You might be thinking, I have some workaholic tendencies, but I also love my work. Can I be both? The answer is yes. Scholars have referred to these individuals who have workaholic tendencies and also high work engagement as engaged workaholics. One myth about workaholism is the belief that if you are an engaged worker, this will cancel out any negative effects of being a workaholic. The tiny kernel of truth is that loving your work may provide a slight buffer from the most negative outcomes of workaholism. Other research flat out debunks this myth of the engaged workaholic as a positive form of workaholism, finding any positive effects of work engagement were effectively eliminated if the individual was also a workaholic. Thus, loving your work may provide, at best, slightly less negative outcomes, but most likely any benefits of loving your work may eventually be washed out by your work compulsion, particularly if we look at the long-term risks of workaholism. Insight number three, workaholics are not more productive. One of the biggest myths about workaholism is that workaholics are more productive. In fact, there's a great deal of research suggesting at best there's no relationship between workaholism and productivity, and at worst, that workaholism is detrimental to performance. There are several reasons for this. First, it is well documented that workaholics tend to overextend themselves and don't leave time to recover. Recovery experiences, not just restful sleep, but also letting go of your work when you're awake, which is called psychological detachment, are essential processes that allow us to replenish the energy, both mental and physical, that we expended during the workday. Not only do workaholics not adequately recover from work, but they also operate in constant fight or flight mode. There is a cumulative effect of strain on our bodies, so as we work more, we need even more recovery. This cumulative strain makes us less effective at work as the number of hours we work increases. Think about your own energy levels at the beginning of the workday compared to the end of the workday. Do you notice a difference in how productive you are? Economist John Pinkovel has been studying this phenomenon for decades, and his models show that after about 55 hours of work, productivity starts to decrease. In fact, applying his law of diminishing returns, someone who works 70 hours is no more productive than someone who puts in 55 hours. Workaholics can also be difficult teammates and bosses, setting unrealistic timelines and causing unnecessary stress for others by overcommitting the team. They may also be more likely to engage in certain forms of counterproductive work behavior, such as aggression and incivility. Our worship of the ideal worker, someone fully devoted to and available for the job, continues to perpetuate this myth that workaholics are the best workers because we are still getting rewarded for putting in long hours. Case in point, research conducted in the consulting industry found that managers could not tell the difference between those who were workaholics and those who pretended to be workaholics. Both groups received similar performance evaluations, even though their actual work hours varied dramatically. Insight number four, it's more important than ever before to disconnect from work. Technology tethers us to our work through smartphones and productivity apps such as Slack and Teams, and the majority of workers regularly check their emails on their smartphones, which never leave our side, even after work hours or on vacation. The rise in remote work means work and family spheres are no longer separate, blurring the boundaries between work and home. Or as Andrew Barnes, co-founder of 4-Day Week Global, put it to me, we're not working from home, we're sleeping in the office. This is our new world of work. During the pandemic, workdays became longer and we got used to working outside traditional work hours. Microsoft conducted several studies analyzing keystroke and Teams chat data. Comparing data gathered during COVID to pre-pandemic data, during the pandemic, we were much more likely to work in the evenings, typically between 8 and 11 p.m., in what has been dubbed the triple peak day. Second, during the pandemic, we were much more likely to work during the weekends. As the data indicate, the amount of work messages sent and received on the weekends increased during COVID by 200%. Unfortunately, the patterns that emerged in a crisis have been normalized. We have gotten used to them, just in the same way people may develop a bad habit. What's even worse is that this increased workload, connectivity to work, and altered communication patterns have been tacked on to our existing schedules, meaning we are working longer and staying more tethered to work than ever before. Insight number 5. Leaders and organizations may be unintentionally encouraging overwork. In the book, I discuss several ways in which a leader's workaholic tendencies encourage overwork amongst their team and subordinates. Many of these may be more obvious, such as the boss who's constantly texting their employees and expecting an immediate response, or the boss that overcommits the unit by making unrealistic promises to clients for when a project can be completed. Perhaps you are a workaholic and you genuinely want your employees to have more work-life balance than you have. You may be saying all the right things, but if you are role modeling workaholic behaviors, say working long into the evening or spending weekends sending work emails, your team will notice this and try to conform to what is being modeled to them. Even if you don't identify as a workaholic, you still may be unintentionally encouraging overwork. Perhaps you've heard the suggestion to add a statement to your email indicating something like, "I may have different work hours than you. Feel free to respond during your regular work hours." Your intention is in the right place, but this may still be problematic. Industrial organizational psychologist Lauren Kirkendall calls this status blindness, a phenomenon where people in higher level positions assume those with less power have the same amount of agency as they do. In other words, just because a leader might be able to choose whether or not to respond to an email or to stay at work to finish a project, this doesn't necessarily mean that individuals working underneath them will feel the same degree of power to make that decision. So even with a well-intended message in your email assuring employees they do not need to immediately respond, there may be too much pressure due to company norms and expectations, or due to the leader's influence over key rewards, that your subordinates don't feel they can wait to respond to that email. Overwork may also be unintentionally encouraged and reinforced at the organizational level. For example, regardless of how much an organization touts its employee wellness initiatives and work-family policies, if the norm in the company is that bosses send emails at 10 o'clock and no one uses their vacation time, employees will quickly pick up on this discrepancy, and you can actually create more cynicism. It's not enough to simply listen to what the organization says it values. It's more important to look closely at things like what behaviors get rewarded, who gets promoted, what qualities are highly prized in your organization. As a society, we continue to perpetuate the myth that long hours and devotion to work are indicative of performance because of the ever-present overwork norms in our society. We see the dangers of overwork and workaholism all around us, and we just can't pass off the blame to the workers themselves. Organizations and societies need to recognize the role they play in the problem. It may be daunting to try to tackle a problem that seems as massive and systemic as this. It will not be easy or quick. It is also not something that individuals can themselves fix, although the role of individuals in the larger organizational system are critical. My hope is that I've provided you with some research-backed tools to begin the process of reevaluating and resculpting the way we work. It is, in fact, possible for organizations to be wildly successful when they value both productivity and the health and well-being of workers. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Melissa. That was Melissa Clark with 5 big ideas from Never Not Working, Why the Always-On Culture is Bad for Business and How to Fix It. Also, check out our book bite for Work Won't Love You Back, How Devotion to Our Jobs Keeps Us Exploited, Exhausted, and Alone by Sarah Jaffe. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.